Hello, everybody, and welcome to tonight's film review. Yes, we are back. We've had a brief hiatus over the Christmas period, and as most of you will have known, some of the things like the book club, some of the things like the film club, they did go on hiatus because obviously my son was born at the beginning of March. I was planning for that, then he was born, and we were also doing a lot of stuff with the house. So some of the things went on the back burner, and we are back, and we're back with a big film. So I hope you're all going to enjoy this, and I hope you will share the stream. I hope you'll enjoy it. We're live on Odyssey, we're live on Rumble, we're live on DLive, and we are live on Entropy. If any of the streams go down, we're live in those other places, so you can check them out. And if you can please share this stream, it would be appreciated. Now, I've seen a lot of people review Snow White so far, that as in the 2025 Snow White, and a lot of people have dunked on it quite heavily. And this certainly isn't going to be a stream where we're coming out to defend it. But as of yet, I haven't seen any content creators, either on YouTube or alternative media, do reviews of the original, then compare it directly with the 2025 release. But we're going to go a bit further than that. We are not going to be just reviewing the first and then the second. We're going to review the first and we're going to compare it with the original Brothers Grimm fairy tale. Then we are going to review the second, comparing it to the first and the Brothers Grimm fairy tale. So this is going to be a little bit different. It's going to take 2 hours. We're going to try and split it pretty evenly. So sort of 40, 45 minutes reviewing each film, then a discussion at the end. And if you guys have got questions, you can super chat. Now, a lot of people have been saying, look, Mark, I want to send you a donation, but Odyssey isn't working anymore. Well, Odyssey isn't working for anybody. It's over. Not Odyssey. Odyssey's still going. But Stripe, the payment processor who used to work with Odyssey, have basically pulled the plug. Now, they had told Odyssey they were going to pull the plug and they wanted a separation. And Odyssey have been putting in a new system of payments, but it's been taking them longer than they initially anticipated. Now, Stripe said, look, we will keep giving you payment processing, services up until you sort something out. We're not going to sort of just pull the plug. And then the other day, they pulled the plug. They completely upended the plans that Odyssey had for a smooth transition to a new way of processing payments, which is a really awful thing to do. And a lot of nationalist content creators absolutely relied on Odyssey for a living. And by doing this, it's obviously an attack on free speech and on content creators. So if I can ask you all a small favor, we do have super chats still open, but they are through Entropy. The Entropy link is in both of the chats tonight on Rumble and on Odyssey. And obviously, it was in the link when I shared this. So if you would like to send a super chat, if you'd like to support my work, please do. And please consider giving generously. As I said, we've just had a new arrival in the house, and Stripe have taken away my ability to earn a living through Odyssey. So if you guys can support me, I would be very, very appreciative of that, very, very thankful. And if you want to leave a question about the films or your opinion about the films, you can also do that. That would be very much appreciated. And I want to make the point as well that Entropy does work when you're offline, because a lot of people watch these streams after and they might give a small donation to myself or other content creators. Well, if you're looking for that button to send a super chat or just a donation, just look for the Odyssey link. It's the pinned comment in the comment sections down below, and you can still donate via that means, and that's still good at the moment. So please consider doing that. Otherwise, myself and other content creators are going to hit really hard. Anyway, let's get into this tonight. I've got Donald Kent here with me. Everyone knows him. He's a fantastic artist. He's a fantastic content creator from America. Donald, if you just say hi, and then I'll introduce St. Harrison, and we'll get on with it.
Oh, just very, very happy to be here. Thank you so much. Congratulations on your newborn child. Also, hello to Saint Harrison. I don't think we've met yet. You guys can find my content on the Donald Kent Art on YouTube, Donald Kent Art on Substack. and my book Imperium Calling is on Amazon. So I'm really excited to get in today's show.
St. Harrison, how are you doing, my friend? Give yourself a brief intro, then we'll get into the actual stream.
Oh, it's good to be back. Good evening, everyone. I mean, yeah, we were due to be back in December, which means I watched The Order for absolutely nothing, but thankfully made up for it by watching 4 hours of Snow White. And yeah, it's good to meet you too, Donald. I don't think we've ever streamed together. They should be good.
Well, let's get into it. I'm really looking forward to this. Now, I've watched these two Snow White films over the weekend. I watched them both with the wife, actually. So I'm going to give you some of her opinions, too, because she had some thoughts on this. And we're going to start with the 1937 Snow White. Now, the 1937 Snow White is really seen as the classic Disney film, the sort of quintessential Disney. Snow White, and its full title, actually, because it does have a full title. It's commonly known as Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. You know, but it is above that title. It was always Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And the Walt Disney Company took the Brothers Grimm fairy tale and they adapted it to an 83-minute runtime film. And that film was a massive hit, and everyone says it really holds up even today. And I've got to say this, I fired it up, and when you see the animation, the coloring, really everything to do with the art and presentation of this film, it's timeless. Now, this was made 88 years ago, and I would say it's not only a triumph of filmmaking, but also a triumph of Western art. And you have to remember, back then, nothing was done with AI, nothing was done with computer models. There weren't massive banks of buzzing, you know, computers, graphics cards, and processors filling in the work. Everything you see on screen has been hand drawn. Every single cell of animation was drawn by hand by an artist, and then it was colored, filled, and it's flawless. As I said, it's 88 years old this year, but watching it, I've got to say, despite it being 88 years old, everything in terms of its visual appeal and presentation holds up today. And when you actually, or when I watched it anyway, I immediately compared it to sort of modern children's films, modern CGI, computer-generated children's films. And some of them are good. I'm not saying they're all bad. I'm not saying they're all terrible, because I've enjoyed films like Angry Birds. My daughter loves Hotel Transylvania because she loves monsters and vampires. And, you know, they're not bad. They're not bad. Or they're not all bad. Some are worse than others. But there is something special about watching a film like the 1937 Snow White, because you know that teams of European men sat there for hours, painstakingly drawing every background, every cell of animation, and there was probably separate colorists, and syncing it all up to the words. Because this isn't like a modern CGI film where a guy puts on a special headset or a woman puts on a special headset and there's a computer model and the guy does his lines, he moves his face, and the special headset feeds that back into a program which then feeds that information into the model of the character, and it's all done really through the magic of computers and technology. Everything that you see on film, every time Snow White says something, every time a character speaks, every expression had to be drawn. And I can't imagine how difficult that was. And again, it's not like, because everyone knows I'm a graphic designer. When you produce something in the modern era, in a modern graphic design package, be it, you know, one of the Adobe packages or CorelDRAW, if you make a mistake, you just click the back button and that mistake is gone. But when you're producing an 3-minute film. And I think film runs, if I'm wrong, Don will tell me, is it 24 frames a second these films used to run at?
I think that's about right.
Yeah.
I think it's 25 in America, so we would have had to do one more for every second.
Bloody hell.
By the way, there is a documentary of these studios and how the whole process works. I don't know the name of it, but you can look up Disney Studios, you know, blah, 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 and check it out. Amazing.
Well, I was going to say, for some reason, my computer is playing up, which is really irritating. So something has decided it doesn't want to work on my computer, which is annoying to say the least. Ah, that's it. It's unfrozen itself. Anyway, if you're looking at the kind of work that goes into something like this, if you've got 25 frames per second, you've got 1,500 frames per minute, and there was 83 minutes in the film. So you're talking 124,500 frames of animation for one single feature film, which, when you think about it, is absolutely mind-boggling. True. And for it all to be drawn by hand, it's incredible. I would say it's definitely one of the crowning achievements of white artistry. Anyway, I've spoken quite a bit, and I want to talk about the artistic side of this first and the initial impression it made on you. So, Donald, what were your initial impressions, and what do you think of the animation and the art?
Well, you know, as an artist, writer, musician myself, I'm really, really sensitive to all this. I first saw the film somewhere around, I think, maybe 5 years old, and my mom bought a record of it, and we would listen to it together and sing the songs together when I was a young child. So this movie is like grafted onto my DNA. It's really, you know, I really, really love it. And I do see the difference, of course, between the Brothers Grimm content versus the entertainment content of, you know, what's good for kids. And we'll get into that later. But it's stunning. It's truly stunning. I think that, again, it's a reflection of the standards that our people had in those times. And again, how we've fallen right from that. But it's something that, you know, this seems like a simple show, the simple topic. It's just kind of fun and cute or something. But no, it actually has a much greater meaning and a much deeper purpose for us to look at the history of our people, what we do, what we've accomplished, and try to get back to that, to grab a hold of that. Yes, we're in the age of technology and, you know, CGI, all this other stuff. But where's the soul? It all comes from the soul. So there's so much that I have to say, but I don't want to kind of overdo it too early here. But I love it. It's a beautiful film.
Okay, so Harrison, what were your thoughts on the presentation of the film?
Well, I watched it yesterday. I haven't seen it for about 20 years when my brother and sister are much younger and the DVD came out. And it's just really nice to look at. I know we're going to go over the other aspects, but given its age and how it was made, the colours still stand out. You don't even have to like have the sound on. It's just, you could pause it at any point and it looks nice. And it's so whimsical as well. And even though it deviated from the story slightly, it still had aspects and looked very European, which is basically what it is. It's made by European people who actually cared about what they were doing and wanted a nice product at the end of it. So no, it's highly recommended, even if you don't have kids and you're in your 40s.
Now, one of the aspects of this film is obviously it was adapted from a very, very dark fairy tale. And as such, it was toned down in numerous ways. But throughout the film, there were still a lot of very dark themes that made it in to the actual film. The thought of a stepmother marrying a man, doing away with him, then trying to kill her stepdaughter out of bitter jealousy because the stepdaughter is more beautiful is a dark theme. Sending her to the woods to, you know, pick flowers and fruit with the huntsman who is meant to murder her, again, is very, very dark. And this theme of jealousy runs throughout. And actually, despite the whimsical nature of the film, I think there are quite a number of adult themes, but there is a lot cut from the fairy tale. And some of the darker aspects, including sort of the death of the evil stepmother, are massively, massively dialed back because this was aimed at children. And it was made in a time as well where violence on screen, especially violence on screen in front of children, would have been something that would be absolutely taboo. And for good reason. And I think that Walt Disney, when he was producing this, he was genuinely trying to produce family-friendly, uplifting media based on European tradition. And I don't really think anything like that gets produced in the mainstream today. Anything produced in the mainstream today, I think, is completely tainted and warped by, if you want, for want of a better term, wokeism. But I would say that most things that are woke are in fact actually anti-white. That's how I would categorize them. So what did you guys think? We'll start with you again, Donald. What did you think of the main themes of this? And when you're watching it as an adult in 2025, were you disappointed that it didn't stick more closely to the original fairy tale? Or did you sort of understand and accept the compromises made and sort of Walt Disney's vision of bringing these fairy tales to the big screen in a family-friendly manner?
Well, first off, there's an interesting concept to bring into this framework here. The concept of children is somewhat new. In olden times, children were you know, there was no such thing as that. They were just small adults. They were treated not very much different. They weren't protected the way that they are today. It's the kind of thing people can research and look into. I understand even that the word teenager was invented in the 1940s or something. So this is some recent information I've looked up. So I think the idea of protecting children didn't really exist, perhaps, in the times of the Grimm fairy tales when those were being written. And probably life was a lot harsher. You know, people just saw things and had to deal with things that were cold and difficult, you know, and brutal even. So I suppose that it's just a different era, you know, maybe at the time of industrialization or something, that, you know, people just didn't have the notion that we need to protect children from these things. I'm more modern in the regard of, like, I do think children should have, you know, protection in this regard. But I also feel that the 1937 version that we all kind of grew up with, what I feel is the original version, because I knew that, of course, before the Grimm fairy tales, is really right on point in terms of it creates a world that is safe. It's a world that is beautiful. It is a world that it's okay to dream and have this sort of like playful fantasy. It sort of, maybe it has kind of rosy glasses looking at the old times of kings and queens and feudalism and this sort of thing, which is, I think, very much a part of the romanticism of the European spirit. You know, it's certainly from the American view. So I find a lot of charm and comfort in that. So with that being the case, you know, comparing it to the new film, it's really, you know, we'll get into that as the show goes on. But that's my sense of it, is that, you know, I really feel it's important to reestablish and or protect this time and space, this kind of cultural space where we're in our own world among ourselves, and we have that space to dream and feel the joy that Walt Disney had, and that, you know, he produced many, many films with that spirit. So I think that kind of encapsulates my view.
St. Harrison, same question to you, my friend.
I mean, I know it deviates from the book, but I don't think it deviates all too much, because the film is still quite dark. She still sends her off to get killed and bring back her heart. and she gets bumped off at the end, somewhat nicer than she does in the book. And I think kids can handle that to a degree and should be able to, because they need to know that there are dangers out there. And this film is about protecting yourself against dangers. So if you're warned not to open the doors to someone with rubbish excuses like Snow White is, but she does it anyway, you haven't really got seven dwarfs there to bring you around afterwards. And I think, as Donald was saying, it was a different time back then. People went to the cinema to see things a bit more uplifting compared to what were in their daily life. So you can't blame Walt for toning it down, to be honest. And let's not forget that Walt was anti-Semitic, which is why the film looks like it does now. And if he saw the one that was made nowadays in his name, he'd probably have a bit more to say.
Well, I've just looked it up, the film, on Wikipedia. I'm just going to look it up again, just so I get the figures exactly right. They're in my head, but I want to get them exactly right. I'm going to read this verbatim. Now, this film cost $1.5 million to make in 1937. So I don't know what the inflation calculator would have that. So what was the inflation between 1937 and present day? So what's that? Bloody hell. The inflation calculator. I'm going to try and get this right just so that people will actually, you know, have a good sort of grasp of this. So 1.5 million back in 1937, it would have been today would be, let me just click the
33 million.
Oh, I've got it as 86 million. So slightly different. I've got it as 86 million. So this is obviously all going to go wrong now, because I'm going to get the figures wrong. But it made an incredible 418 million at the box office. Okay, now that, I think, would make it about 24 billion box office, which is just incredible. And obviously, when you do these inflation things, I'm sure people have, you know, got different inflation calculators. But for that time, 1.5 million would have been a big spend. But 480 million at the box office would have been the money that built Walt Disney, that built Disney Studios. Now, I just want to go through this briefly, very quickly. The way box office works is the box office take, let's say a film costs 25 million to produce, and there's 100, and it brings in 100 million at the box office. Well, box office takings are split roughly 50-50 between the theatres / cinemas, as we call them in the UK, and the producer of the film. So a film that does 100 million, the producers will get 50 million, the theatre / cinema will get 50 million. Meaning if it costs 25 million to make, the producers have doubled their money. They've doubled their money. Now, this film would have left Walt Disney with $209 million in the bank in 1937 from a 1.5 million spend. So this guy did seriously, seriously big money off this. And it was one of the most, one of these films that, as I say, it holds up today, but it built Disney into what it was. And although it wasn't totally faithful to the source material, I think you could take a family to it. And I can sit there with the wife, my daughter, my son's too young to watch it. And you can watch something like this without fear. And I think that's an important thing to say when talking about this in a modern context. You know your children are not going to see anything sexual. You know they're not going to see anything that is of a politicized or morally twisted nature. You know at the end of it, the good guys are going to prevail. You know that beauty is going to be upheld. Chivalry is going to be upheld. And that, you know, the creepy, weird, bad guy is going to lose. And at the end, the guy's going to walk away with the girl. They're going to get happily married. And it ends happily ever after. And I know that's not really how real life works. But it is, I think, particularly nice to watch something like this compared to what you see most of the time and most of the dross that's pumped out. And there's a lot of these films today that are aimed at children that I don't think you could watch with children. Or if you were watching it with a child, you'd constantly be gritting your teeth at subtle or even not so subtle messages that are woven in. And obviously we'll talk a little bit more about that when we come to the second film. Now, obviously, another thing about this film, it is a musical. And that's not to everyone's taste. I know musicals were a lot bigger back then than they are now. And that's really one of my sort of few gripes about this film personally, is that I'm not the biggest fan of musicals. And if I had any criticism of the 1937 film, is that the cuts they did make from the Brothers Grimm fairy tale were quite heavy narrative cuts. So in Brothers Grimm, the Snow White fairy tale, the evil queen, the evil stepmother, she has three attempts at killing Snow White. First, she turns up as a tailor and she puts a corset on Snow White and tightens it so tight she can't breathe. The dwarves get home, they pull off the corset and save her life. The second time she comes, she puts a poisoned comb in her hair, they lift her up, the comb falls out and she survives. And the third time she comes as the farmer's wife bearing the apples. Now, obviously, they cut a lot of that, and the evil you know, stepmother slash wicked queen, she only comes once in the 1937 one, and she comes as a horrible looking old lady that gives a red apple to Snow White and tells her it's an enchanted apple that she will grant her one wish when she takes a bite. So she wishes to be with the prince, she takes a bite, it's actually a poison apple. All the animals are trying to warn her, and the dwarves race home and confront the evil queen slash stepmother. But I did find that the cuts they made meant that there was quite a lot of these whimsical songs throughout the musical that were, how can I say it, a little bit padded. So there's a lengthy song where the dwarves bath for the first time, and they bath because basically they want to impress Snow White, and they're quite smelly and dirty. She cleans their house for them. So Snow White arrives at the dwarf's cottage. She doesn't think they're dwarves, she thinks they're children because their beds and everything are so small. And she's like, oh my god, these children don't have parents, the house is filthy. So she cleans the house. They get home and they're like, wow, the house is nice, so, and you're quite pretty, so we're gonna let you stay. And then they try to impress her by washing for the first time. But all of these things play out in song. And that's my only real sort of criticism, is the musical narrative for me led to a little bit of possibly boring. A few things played out for too long. There's, you know, one of them was where they were having their first sort of wash together, and that seemed to go on forever. And I've kind of preferred more of the sort of evil queen and the more sort of fast pace or the darker bit from the Brothers Grimm fairy tale. And I will say this, the beginning of the film I thought was fantastic. And the end of the film is very fast paced. The animation is superb. And the battle between the seven dwarves and the wicked stepmother is brilliant. And she dies in the 37 edition in a really interesting way. She actually tries to kill the dwarves, but she bungles what she's doing and falls to her death. So she isn't actually killed in a sort of gruesome way. Whereas in the Brothers Grimm fairy tale, she actually tries to assassinate Snow White at her wedding out in a fit of rage, and she's caught and defeated by the charming prince, and he actually puts iron shoes on her that have been put in a furnace and are red hot, and forces her to dance in red hot iron shoes until she literally collapses and has a heart attack. Obviously, you know, that is a little bit hardcore for kids, so I understand that's why it's cut. But we've got a book at home, and the wicked stepmother, she has a heart attack when she sees the, it's an old Lady Bird book from the 80s, and I read it to Sophia, and Snow White does collapse. The wicked queen, she does collapse when she sees the wedding. She asks the mirror on the wall, you know, mirror, mirror on the wall. And he says, oh, Snow White's the fair. Snow White's dead. No, it's not. It's a wedding. Let me see it, she says. And when she sees it, she has a heart attack in a fit of anger and dies. And I think that could have maybe been in there. So I think in some ways, a few too many things were missed. And my real criticism of the film is some of the padding with overly long songs, which replaced the original narrative. That's my only real criticism. So did you guys have any criticism, or do you think I'm being too critical?
You're really going hard on this. No, I'm not a fan of musicals, so I tend to be, I'd rather see more story. So I lean into what you're saying. And I really like your point about how much story was lost. There could have been so much more drawn from the Brothers Grimm that maybe doesn't have to be so dark. But I feel that that's very much Walt Disney. It's very much the idea of entertainment, family entertainment. So it leans away from sort of literature and into entertainment in that regard. There's in the course of what you were saying, there was a point that I wanted to bring up that I find interesting. It's knowing that good always wins in the end. I think this is a really uniquely Western concept. I find it fascinating in a sort of sociocultural way. It protects the heart of goodness in our people. It creates a positive perception of reality that we in turn somehow align with. You know, if good always wins in the end and you believe that, you're going to behave in alignment with that kind of matrix, so to speak. It makes an interesting sociological study anyway. I just find it seems to be ubiquitous in a lot of the Disney films, this kind of innocence, this notion of, you know, good always wins in the end. So I think from that framework, it's interesting to take this show into looking at the two films and comparing them.
Right, before I throw it over to St. Harris, I just want to say this. What I've actually said was a critique that people had before the film was made. And there was quite a few people at the actual studio who were really, really worried, including leading lights in Hollywood, who said, look, this film could be a good 6 to 7 minutes short, but an hour and a half, they thought it would run out of steam and it wouldn't, there wasn't enough there. But Walt Disney was really, really passionate about this. He actually really, really wanted this to be a big, you know, big studio hit and a demonstration of what, you know, Walt Disney Studios could do. St. Harrison, over to you. What's your thoughts on this?
I mean, yeah, I was going to say the same thing. The story is very short, so it could have just been like a 20-minute cartoon. So you can understand why he filled it out with some songs. As for the one about them all having a wash before she gets home, let's be honest, as blokes, whenever we know a good-looking woman is coming around the house, we all have a quick tidy up and a scrub. So that is a good lesson for the young boys who watch the film to learn. It's interesting that when the film came out, Tolkien and C.S. Lewis went to see it together, and Tolkien described it as vulgar, corrupted, it infantilised the fairy tale, and forbade Disney from ever touching these stories because he didn't want it to end up like the film Snow White, because he said the dwarves should have been ugly because that's what they are in European mythology. But he appreciated the animation and criticised also the low comedy of it, such as the dwarves, because in the story, as you know, the dwarves don't really have any personalities, and in the Disney film, both of them, they're just a bit retarded and they're all given their individual personalities. But no, I can't criticise them for stretching out a 10-minute story into an hour and a half film.
And by the way, I was just going to say, you were right, St. Harrison. I was wrong about the inflation. I was looking at the UK inflation calculator. UK inflation has been far worse than American inflation. American cumulative inflation between 1937 and today is 2,120.8%. And let me just work out how much it would have actually made by today's money at the cinema. Based on that, it would have actually made 9 billion, not the 22 I said. So still be the largest grossing film of all time, you know. If you adjusted for inflation, it was pretty massive.
I do love being right.
You are right, mate. But I'm a big guy. I can admit when I'm wrong. But I do think, looking at this, and this is the last thing I'm going to say about all Disney, and then we'll wrap it up with people's thoughts and a quick score on this, and we'll move on to the next. But I will say this: when you look back at Walt Disney and what he was trying to do, he was clearly, even back in 1937, he was clearly flying in the face of what Hollywood was looking to do. He was trying to produce epic, beautiful, timeless, family-friendly shows and movies based around classic European fairy tales. And imagine if Walt Disney had ended up being the power behind Hollywood and building Hollywood and being the man that shaped Hollywood, I think we'd be living in a completely different world today than the world we're living in. I've always said that America, thanks to Hollywood and the American media, is basically the fountain of all filth that then flows down, you know, pumps out its sewage and bile, which flows down to the rest of the world, corrupting all of us as well. But when you look at what Walt Disney was attempting to do, Walt Disney really was a man that wanted to produce the kind of material that you could view as a family. And when you think about it, actually sitting down together as a family and viewing things as a family and doing things as a family is an important part of life. You know, having mum and dad sat in one room watching what they're watching while older brother sits in another room watching what he's watching, and a little girl sat in her own room on a tablet watching what she's watching, that's not how a family should interact. That's not a way a family should consume media. But when you actually look at what Walt Disney was trying to do, it wasn't only noble, but if it had actually succeeded and been the dominant force in Hollywood, the world would be a different, and I would argue, a much better place. Do you guys want to comment on that? And then we'll give our final thoughts on the 1937 version.
You're right on point. I'm completely connected to that. That's been a really, really hard thing for me over the decades, to go from growing up in a time when things were innocent and good and culturally homogenous and white, to more and more and more of that fountain of filth that you were talking about, you know, and now to the point where I despise, like, I, you know, burn Hollywood, burn. That's my philosophy. So I, you know, and again, part of why I do what I do, creating new culture that is moralizing and healthy, you know, this is a huge part of the mission. So yeah, I'm right alongside you.
What do you think, St. Harrison?
No, I agree with you both. It was a different time back then, and people would all just sit around and watch the same things because everyone had the same values. So whether you're male or female, young or old, you'd all kind of enjoy the same things to a degree. But, you know, like you both said, that doesn't exist nowadays, and you can't trust to let your kids watch something that comes out of Hollywood nowadays, even if it's for a kids' film, because there's going to be trannies and all sorts in it.
Right, so let's give our final thoughts on this. I'll go first. I'm going to say I enjoyed this film more than I thought I was going to enjoy it. And as somebody who works in graphic design, as somebody who's worked with artists, I've got to say it's a beautiful and timeless art style. It's absolutely wonderful. It's based on European fairy tales. I'm not a big fan of musicals. I did feel it dragged a little bit in the centre, but I understand that it's a kids' film and it's a family film, so I can forgive it for that. And I've got to say this is the kind of film that, you know, if aliens visited the Earth and you wanted to put forward a sort of a cross section, a vertical slice of media, putting forward the best of what we do as a species, I think this film would be it. I think this film would be that, would be part of that capsule, that sort of, you know, vertical slice that we'd send them. And I think as such, it's timeless. And when I was watching it, I was struck by two things. The first was how beautiful it was and how incredible those artists were. But the second thing was sort of this profound sadness. I was watching it thinking to myself, why don't we produce anything like this anymore? You know, why have we lost these skills? Because I'm not saying that we just don't produce these things anymore because it's too expensive. I mean, that's an argument we hear all the time. Oh, it's too expensive to do things like this anymore. It's too expensive to have artists drawing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of frames of animation. We just can't do that. It would cost too much money. You know, we just plug it into the computers and it does it. And that saves money and it's a faster process. You know, there's all these arguments about streamlining and speed and the ease of bringing something into fruition. But I think there's something more here. Do we even have the talent to do this? Do we even have these incredible artists around anymore? You know, is there even the capacity? When was the last time anyone saw a film that looked as good as this? You know, this was made 88 years ago, but we're not making anything that looks this good. When was the last time a studio sat down and said, we're going to make this epic and it's all going to be done, you know, like it used to be? We're going to have talented men sit here and they're going to draw it all out and it's going to be done the old way. And we produce something that was truly art. And I know that we call films, music, video games, comic books, they're all art. They're all art. But there's some art is better than other art. I'm big enough to say that. Art is not all created equal. You know, some art is high art and some art is disposable. And everything that we produce today seems so disposable when you put it up against what was produced then. And that makes me sad. It makes me sad as an artist. It makes me sad as a man who loves European art and loves the European spirit. And it makes me sad as a dad. It makes me sad that, you know, to watch a film like this with my kids, we have to go back to 1937. And the stuff that's coming out now is just absolute trash in comparison, especially artistically. I'm going to give the film, I'd say either an 8 or 9 out of 10. And I'm going to give it that. It's not the perfect film for me. It did drag a bit, and I'm not a fan of musicals. But artistically, I'd probably give it an 8 overall for myself. But artistically, it's an 11. It's an 11 out of 10. It's absolutely spectacular. And as I said, my heart aches that we don't produce things like this anymore. Right, give your roundup, both of you guys, on this first film, and then we'll move on to the second.
That was a really hard act to follow. Everything you said was totally brilliant, and I completely agree. I think I will take more of the perspective of a child than an adult in judging the film from you know, and I, like I had mentioned earlier in the show, this film is really a deep part of my family history and that whole connection to my mom, etc. So from a child's point of view, if I can speak from that spirit, I would give it a 10 out of 10. I'm sure that there's, you know, little things I can nitpick about, but I think you touched on some really powerful points here that I want to expand on a little bit. The idea of beauty, aesthetics, it's a kind of magic that programs society. Our enemies know very well about this, and they put in enormous amounts of effort and money to keep our eyes on the screen, teaching us who we are, who they want us to think we are. Snow White and the Seven Dwarves being timeless, it's, you know, like any other kind of timeless art, it offends our enemies. So they have to kind of recreate it, have to break it down, make it filthy, you know, destroy it, insert all their Marxist ideas or what have you, etc., to demoralize us. And then through time, through the generations, they can gradually erode us like a kind of a vine, you know. So I think that that's why this discussion, this show is important. I'm taking kind of a more of a meta-historical, meta-cultural approach to this topic. And I just have to highlight this point you made about, giving the beauty of the film an 11. So this is why art is important. This is why beauty is important. It's an interesting kind of loop where art shows us who we are, and then we behave in alignment with that, which then creates more art, which reflects us in that sort of cultural loop. It's quite profound.
Wake up, St. Harrison, it's your go.
I was waiting for you to tell me. Anyway, no, this film is really good. It moves on at quite a good pace. It didn't seem to drag at all, even with the songs. It is timeless. You could watch it now, you can watch it in 20 years' time, and people would still enjoy it. And what you're saying about the beauty in both the art and the characters themselves, you could show this to like a tribe in the middle of a jungle and they're objectively go, yeah, it is beautiful. So beauty is timeless, and that is what this film's about. In terms of why we don't do these things anymore, it's because it's all about time and money. The last film that looked like this that Disney made was Tangled, and that was just made using computers to look like it was hand-drawn. So the willing's there, it's just not the time, patience, or the talent, unfortunately, which is why we need to bring it back, and I think Donald's going to do that.
I'm part of that effort for sure. If I can quickly tag onto that, I'm sorry if I'm jumping my turn or something, but it really is a testament to how hand painted, hand drawn art will never be, it'll never go out of style. It'll never be overcome by CGI. This idea that, oh, CGI is superior, da, da, da. We'll get into that, like the dwarves and how blah blah blah. There's nothing better than the human hand. You cannot use any form of technology that will outdo that in terms of its quality and preciousness. So I just wanted to pop that in.
Isn't it right though that the cartoons that they make in America, they send over to South Korea to do all the hand drawing rather than do it themselves? I don't know if that's because they can't be asked or they just can't do it.
Animation, for starters, is insanely expensive to produce, and everybody wants to do it. But there's a culture now where ugly animation is the mainstream, that like the kind of lowbrow style of scratching your art out and making it look like you don't know how to draw is the norm or popular or cool or whatever. I just hate it. But yeah, as far as like actual animation studios, right, they outsource it to poor countries.
Fair enough. But no, you kind of saw the bastardization of animation like in the mid-90s with things like Rugrats and stuff like that. Whereas I'm sure like myself, Mark, and you remember things like Count Dracula and the cartoons we had. Yeah, they didn't look anything up to the scale of Snow White, but you could tell some effort went into them.
And interestingly, there's a parallel with fine art. When you look at, the onset of abstract expressionism, and then how postmodernism just scattered art history and turned it into a big nothing. So you have, I can't remember the name. There's an African American guy who did these kind of childlike drawings and cartooning, kind of. Graffiti, all of that street culture became elevated into, oh, this is the great fine art of our day. But no, it's like aiming downwards rather than aiming upwards in terms of like comparing it to our history. It's always about destroying our historic foundations. And this is something that I hate. Of course, we know who's behind a lot of that, who funds it, who directs it, who the all the whole the way the college institutions work to indoctrinate young artists. It's a huge topic.
Agreed. Well, it's been fascinating so far tonight, but let's get on to the meat of this because I think people are here really to find out what we think of Snow White 2025. And look, that's the real title. So I said this earlier, the original 1937 Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. The first thing to note about Snow White 2025 is the seven dwarves do not exist in this film. They're not dwarves, they're simply called magical creatures. And this doesn't bode well, does it? The fact that the dwarves were basically cut and replaced with magical creatures who look like dwarves, because using the term dwarf is apparently offensive to small people. They don't call them small, sorry, little people. They call them little people now, don't they? You can't call them dwarves or midgets. They're little people. So this is just called Snow White. Now, obviously, the big change here is initially, other than the title change and the obvious smell of woke, is the fact that this is a real life film. It stars actors and actresses, and it is a traditional film. It's not animated. But one thing that will hit you straight away when you begin watching this film is it is brought to life with CGI. Now, it's probably going to be a very popular opinion for me to sit here and rag on CGI. And I have ragged on CGI before. And my view is always that people should do things with practical effects, and CGI should be a gentle sort of after effect. CGI should be something that is applied sparingly after the film has been made in post-production to improve it. However, most of this is CGI. Most of this is green screen. People don't have a clue what's around them. It's actors and actresses walking down a set of green stairs towards, you know, a green box in the center of the screen. And that's going to be somebody walking through a courtyard towards a well. And you can see that the actors and actresses in this film do not know what they're walking towards. And this is something that initially broke me out of this film. The CGI in this film, now, it isn't the worst CGI I've ever seen, okay? It isn't the worst. And I'm going to start by saying that I'm not going to be one of these people who talks about this film and just rags on it and says nothing positive, because there are a few positives. But this film cost $270 million to make. Bear in mind, the original cost $1.5 million. This cost $270 million. And it's been a complete box office flop. But with $270 million being spent on it, the CGI is poor, with one exception. The animated animals look fantastic. And the wife said that. The wife we watched with me, she said, those animals look fantastic. They were very cute. You know, the hedgehogs, the squirrels, the deer, they all look brilliant. And a lot of effort was put into their eyes, their fur, etc. But nearly everything else with the CGI is terrible and is a massive, massive step back. This is obviously a live action film, but it's a massive, massive step back from 1937. And if you compare the 1937 dwarves with the 2025 magical, what are they called? Magical creatures, I suppose. They're not human, because that would make them dwarves or midgets. So magical creatures. It's night and day. The 1937 dwarves were whimsical, charming, lovable, and everyone adored them. The 2025 magical creatures are absolutely horrific. And when I say horrific, I mean that uncanny valley horrific, where you know that the creator is trying to make something look as close to human as possible, but it looks freaky and uncomfortable, because despite hundreds of millions of dollars being spent to make this look as human as possible, it looks horrifying. I mean, these look terrible. And putting them side by side, I think this was sort of one of my pre-recorded videos, I'd do this, but putting them side by side, they are absolutely awful. And as I said, the animals do look great in this film. The forest animals, which were present in both films, look fantastic in the 2025. Some of the best CGI I've seen, actually, especially on the hedgehog and the squirrels. They look great. But everything else is pure trash, and the dwarves were awful. And now, before this film came out, I remember people really kicking off and saying, hey, why aren't the dwarves why aren't they real little people playing the roles of the dwarves? Why aren't the people like Peter Dinklage being given the role? He's an amazing actor, one of the best actors of our age. Why isn't he being one of the dwarves? And they were really, really, you know, stern about this. It's got to be CGI. Well, it looks absolutely shocking. embarrassingly bad. And somebody in the chat, British Gammon, said 270 million was only up to 2023 before the reshoots. So reshoots aren't included in this figure. Same, that was the same for Captain America Brave New World. They're saying, oh, it didn't cost as much as all the pundits are saying. Well, they haven't included the reshoots in the sort of 250 million they're telling people it cost. Apparently with reshoots and marketing, that film cost up to 400 million. But Wikipedia and the Wikipedia scribes are trying to protect these films by doing things like exclude the reshoots. But even without reshoots, it made 180 million at the box office off a 270 million budget. So it would have needed to make, without reshoots, 540 million at the box office to break even. And it ain't ever doing that. But look, I've spoken a lot. And I want to throw this over to you guys straight away. What did you think of the CGI? Because obviously, it's hard to turn. And this is quite a noble thing, actually. The original was high art. But it is difficult to try and turn something like a whimsical animation into a live action. But for my money, these guys totally failed. What do you guys think about the CGI? Starting with you, Donald.
You couldn't be more right. I honestly feel that knowing the amazing abilities that they have with CGI and all the amazing films and scenes, et cetera, that have been done already with it, I would almost wager money that they made the dwarves literally ugly, like on purpose almost. Like they're almost nightmarish, you know. That, I mean, the quality of the CGI is definitely not up to what it could be. And then they're just creepy and ugly, you know, the big heads and the texture of their skin. It's just disturbing. Like you had mentioned before the show, that was sort of like bad video game art or something. And I've noticed overall the film is generally kind of dark. There's a lot of scenes in the film that are taking place in dark, like dark castles with, you know, or the cave, or they're here and there. And then also there's a kind of a light blue filter through over. As an artist, I kind of see these things. And, you know, there's lots of great CGI movies, you know, whatever. And they don't have that blueness or that darkness to them. I mean, this is just an overall judgment, but yeah, specifically the seven dwarves are so important and so whimsical and playful and central to this story that to flub that, to drop the ball on that, to me is like, I'm almost, you know, convinced that they meant to do it. And I know that's probably silly to think, like conspiracy theory or something, but how can you screw that up? How can you make it that bad? I don't know.
I often wondered when I was watching, I was thinking, did they get it really bad? But you know, after all, you know, when you're doing something and it's not turning out the way you want it, and you're looking at the canvas and you're like, after a while you start thinking, yeah, it's not too bad, it'll be passable. Do you think that's what they did? Anyway, so Jason Harrison, what do you think?
No one will notice. I'll just slip it under the rug there. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's just, it's only 270 million.
Yeah, right.
Jason Harrison, what do you think?
Phone it in.
The dwarves did look absolutely hideous, but remember, they are magical creatures, so you kind of take it with a pinch of salt there. I know you mentioned Peter Dinklage, but he's the one who complained about them hiring actual dwarves to play the dwarves, which is why they went down the animated route. So he's like got seven of his mates out of the job, and it would have been better. In terms of the other CGI, I have to disagree with you both slightly. I didn't think it was all that egregious. It is a fantasy. It doesn't need to look 100% real. It could have been a bit sharper. It could have been a bit clearer. But I think some of it, including the dwarves, was down to the reshoots and them panicking because of the lead actress running her mouth a bit too much before it came out. So they had to change things. The bits that stood out for me that annoyingly was how they're in a real forest for like 5 minutes of the film and the rest is all just CGI. It just seemed disjointed. But no, I don't have that many qualms about the CGI other than dwarves looking disgusting.
Well, the next thing I've got to say, and this is sort of one of those Disney things, isn't it? A Disney princess is meant to be beautiful. And I've got a daughter and she's 5 years old now, and she is a big fan of Disney princesses. And there is often the debate in our house, you know, before we go out and before she reaches into that dressing up box, over which Disney princess she is going to be. And she loves them. You know, she likes Snow White. She likes Belle from Beauty and the Beast. She likes Anna and Elsa from Frozen. She likes Ariel from The Little Mermaid. And I think there are a lot of beautiful women out there, a lot of beautiful women out there who could have played Snow White. And Rachel Zegler is not one of them. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say she's a disgusting, freakish, you know, ugly troll woman or something, because she's not. You know, you're not going to walk past her in the street and go, oh my God, she is disgusting. But I think you could walk past her in the street and not give her a second glance. She is not beautiful. And most importantly, she's not Snow White. Her skin is not Snow White. Now, in the original, I remember the sort of little look my wife gave me when it says her skin was as white as snow. And, you know, when we watched the 2025, she was like, I don't think that line's going to be in there this time, is it? And it's not. It was obviously cut out. Right. You know, the whole thing of Snow White was called Snow White because her skin was as white as snow. And in 2025, it's a bad omen that she isn't white. And not only is she not white, but they explain why she's called Snow White, because apparently she was conceived or born, one or the other, in a snowstorm. And it's like, what? That doesn't even make any sense. It's just contrived. And again, you know, we said they sort of phoned in the dwarves, like, well, they're good enough. We call them magical creatures and they're good enough. Look, it's cost $270 million. Just get it out there. And somebody said, look, boss, how are we going to come up with a new way of explaining how she's going to be called Snow White? Because there has to be some sort of explanation. And they're like, well, we can't say it's about her skin color, because one, that will be crucified for being racist. And two, Rachel Zegler isn't white, so it'll make no sense. What are we going to do? Something born in a snowstorm? And everyone sort of looked at each other and were like, that's pretty lame. Somebody went, well, you got anything better? And they were like, look, we're 8 cafetieres of coffee in now. It's 3 a.m. We've spent $270 million. It'll have to do. And I think there's going to be a theme going through this review of it'll have to do, because there's so many of these moments. And I know Gal Gadot is Jewish. Okay. I know she's Jewish, but Gal Gadot is whiter than Snow White. And not only is she whiter than Snow White, I actually think she's more attractive than Rachel Zegler. And the whole point of Snow White is that Snow White is more beautiful than the evil queen / wicked stepmother. And Rachel Zegler is not beautiful, but Gal Gadot, you know, I know she's Israeli, I know she's Jewish, but she did win Miss Israel. And sadly, because of the name she works under, I'm not sure if that's a real name. I doubt it is. I can Google that. Most people think she's French. But it is jarring that you have Gal Gadot looking into the mirror saying, mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the fairest of them all? And the mirror's like, snow not so white? And then it sort of like cuts to Rachel Zegler, who just doesn't look attractive at all. You're just kind of like, yeah, I mean, if Gal Gadot and Rachel Zegler both walked into a bar and you had to pick between them, I'm not sure anyone would pick Rachel Zegler.
Right.
You know, she's got sunken eyes. She isn't attractive. She hasn't got a nice figure. She's not busty. Like the original Snow White, she had a lovely figure. And the dwarves obviously really, really liked her. And sort of like, you know, fawned all over her. And you can see why, because she was drawn that way. But like, Rachel Zegler just isn't attractive. And I was just watching it. I was thinking to myself, none of this makes sense. The casting was absolutely awful. And let's just talk about the Zegler-Gadot sort of situation for a few seconds, because I think then we're going to have to come on to the sort of colorblind casting. And, you know, And one thing I will say about Gal Gadot, I mean, people are obviously going to rip me for saying that I find like a Israeli or Jewish woman attractive, but these ladies often have a lot of surgery. You know, people regularly don't know that Scarlett Johansson from the Avengers is Jewish. And if you look at her in her early career and post plastic surgery, she looks very different. But I don't think it's a controversial thing to say that Gal Gadot is actually more attractive than Rachel Zegler. But what do you think, Donald? What do you think about the new Snow White, born in a snowstorm, not white? It literally defeats a central narrative of the film before it's even made.
Okay, so you're onto something here. So this is so much a part of that whole Marxist, leftist, whatever you want to call it, woke idea that people can tell you that something is not what it is on the surface, that you can, you know, the sky is green and the grass is blue. Boys can be girls. Girls can be boys. Captain America is black. Snow White is Hispanic or whatever, whatever, whatever. It's always, it's kind of a jarring cognitive dissonance, especially to children, to say like, oh, you know, this is the definition of beauty. It is better than, you know, X is better than Y, what have you. And so this is a kind of theme that just keeps coming up in woke entertainment over and over and over, that, you know, it's always the white guy is the villain, or, you know, or he's weak, or there's something like, even the male hero in this is, he looks like he needs a bath or something. He's just kind of this, you know, just got out of a San Francisco barista job. He's just on the street now or something. It doesn't have any masculine qualities that whatever, whatever. So here it is, that always telling people that something is the opposite of what it appears to be. I find that really disturbing, but I want to take it a step farther here. There's a locket that the father gives Snow White in the beginning of the film that I don't believe that was in the, that's not in the original film. And on the locket are these qualities that she's supposed to look for a man who, you know, marry him and he'll be the king. And one of those things is that he is to be fair, you know? And so I thought, huh, interesting. So they're recontextualizing the word fair, right? Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? That line is so central to this movie, to this story. So, but if you change fair, you see where I'm going. It just adds more cognitive dissonance to the story. You know, Snow White, of course, fair meaning like fair play, you know, that kind of thing. I might be stretching a little bit, but I feel like it does pull away from this notion that fair skin is beautiful. You know, somehow or other, they have to kind of thwart that. But yet, how? You know, I think they must have been very frustrated to figure out how can we make someone who is not white skinned more beautiful than someone who is. So there's, I think that's, they're kind of breaking the fourth wall a little bit there. They're kind of exposing themselves in some way. What do you think, Harrison?
I never thought of it like that. But yeah, they are changing the use of the word fair just to keep the brown and black kids happy in the audience, because if they've got someone nowadays going, who's the fairest of them all? Well, obviously it's the beautiful ish white girl. But you have to wonder if originally Snow White was going to be black, but then they released The Little Mermaid, saw what happened there and thought, no, let's not go that far this time. We've learned our lesson. Let's give it to an ugly Colombian.
If I can jump in real quick, there's a great clip. You know, of course, The Little Mermaid came out and it was a kind of black mulatto girl who was playing the role. And I found this clip online. It was a black family that was about to show their black daughter, who was probably 6, 7 years old, you know, hey, that's the new mermaid movie. We're going to show it to you now. Are you ready? And this little girl is in love with the Little Mermaid. She's a huge fan, so excited. And they turn the movie on. And when you finally see the Little Mermaid is not black, this black girl turns to her mom and dad and is like really upset. And she's like, the Little Mermaid is white, you know? and the parents are like trying to fight her on it, like, oh, no, this is the one. And no, this is not, I'm not going to watch this movie. I reject this. So, like, children have, I don't know.
Kids aren't stupid, are they?
Yes, I know. And it's, that's the difficulty of this, is watching these adults try to teach children that, you know, black is white and up is down and girls are boys and all this garbage. So it's very frustrating.
Oh, I agree.
Right, just for the record, her real name is Greenstein.
No, no.
Don't feel like if I'd have guessed that, someone would have said it would have been anti-Semitism, wouldn't they? You know, people were saying, people were saying in the chat, Gal Gadot. Gadot's not her real name, Mark. Guess one. If I'd have gone, it's Greenstein, people would be, no, mate, you're having us on. I'm going to call her, it's Greenstein.
You mean she's not French, you know?
She's not French, mate. She's not French, but it's one of those big changes. So, wait. Let's go on to the colorblind casting. I'm going to talk a little bit about it, but I'm going to talk about one of the most ridiculous parts of the colorblind casting that I've ever seen. So it's even beyond the fact Snow White isn't white anymore. And as you so rightfully pointed out that I missed, the fairest of them all is a person who's fair and just, not fair skinned. But immediately, you're sort of thrust into this sort of CGI European marketplace, which is obviously within the walls of this magnificent European castle, and everything is multiracial. Like, you know, there are mixed race couples, there are blacks, there are Indians, and they're all dancing together and they're all singing, and it really, really does force it down your throat. And there's several points in the film where it is absolutely egregious. At the end is one of the worst, where Snow White is captured by the evil queen, and she orders her guards to execute them, and they're basically, her guards are brainwashed men who used to be like good men, and Snow White reminds them all who they used to be and that they were better people, and sort of breaks the brainwashing, and they all refuse to execute her. But that is a proper multiracial section where the four guards, the sort of a white, a black, an Indian and a mixed race, and it's kind of like, let's have a rainbow group, and they'll all come together at the end and turn against, quite ironically, turn against the Israeli Jew. That would be, you know, interesting. Right. The brainwash. I mean, obviously, that's not the meaning of the film, but if you read it that way, it would be quite funny. But one of the worst bits for me that made me laugh is part of the narrative of Snow White is that the evil queen / stepmother orders her to be killed, and she orders the huntsman to take her to the woods to pick flowers and then kill her. And in the original, the huntsman is, he looks like a hunter. He looks like a European hunter from the Middle Ages. He's got a beard, a hunter's hat, a cloak, and sort of leather outfit, which would allow him to crawl through like the undergrowth or move through brambles, etc. And, you know, he looks like a European hunter. In the new one, he's black. But for some reason, some genius in this process, this filmmaking process, where they made these ridiculous calls about the dwarves, where they made ridiculous calls about how Snow White was to be named, about how they were going to redefine the word fair. But some genius in the new modern woke Walt Disney company decided that the huntsman was going to be the blackest black man they could find. But instead of wearing a traditional European hunter's hat, he was going to wear a military beret. And it looks ridiculous. He looks like one of those military dictators from a film called Lord of War, which had Nicolas Cage. You know, when you see these black guys with AK-47s and they've got, you know, sort of a vest on with magazines in it, and they're, you know, no shirt underneath, they're running through sort of a dilapidated, run down and heavily shelled city, firing from the hip with their AK-47, but they've got one of these berets on it. I looked at the wife and I said, have they done this on purpose? Why on earth would the huntsman not be wearing a traditional hunter's hat but be black and literally look like he's got a beret on it, so he could be in like Black Hawk Down or Lord of War? I thought, why did they pick this? And the whole thing was so jarring. It was just so unbelievable. Because not only are they sort of recasting him as a black man, but they're more or less saying he's actually an African, you know, he's an African warlord straight out of Liberia. That's what he looks like with his beret on. And at this point, I'm scratching my head because I'm thinking, okay, I understand that you're doing the colorblind casting for wokeness, but why pair it with like the stereotypical African military dictator beret? It just doesn't make any sense. Like, it's almost as if they can't. But don't you think if we put him in the hunter's hat, that's what everyone's expecting? Yeah. Why don't we put him in the stereotypical African dictator beret? Because that'll confound the audience. It'll be making a statement about power in medieval, in our multiracial medieval Europe. But in the end, it almost looked like they were trying to stereotype him. So despite trying to be woke, it literally had me in stitches. I have a British guy in the chat said he looks like Idi Amin. He looks like a thinner version of Idi Amin. If he was in The Last King of Scotland, you'd be like, oh, they took him directly out of there. And when he was changing, you know, the costume people forgot to change his hat. It's just ridiculous. So what was your thoughts on the colorblind casting, guys? Start with you, Donald.
Yeah, I mean, and his suit was even green as well, which had that military quality. You know, when he pulled the knife out and he went for her, I was thinking, well, in reality, yeah, he wouldn't stop her, but, you know that. But the other side, the thing that kind of stood out to me is when the black guard caught the white thief who end up being the love interest, you know, later. And I'm like, oh, that's of course the perfect opposite of how life really works. But yeah, I don't know. I'm like the beginning, the opening scene where everyone's dancing and singing together and such joyful peace, la la la. You know, I'm like, this is like, it just hurts your stomach. It's just so cringe because it's so fake. And like I said earlier in the show, I think this film, or did I say it? I don't know, but I feel like this film is extremely self-conscious. Like even the actors seem to have a kind of like, they know that they're destroying the tradition of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs by remaking it this way. That's my sense. I don't know if anyone else felt that, but you know, making it woke, et cetera, knowing what Disney is, knowing that Disney is dying, you know, financially, and the world is changing and people are rejecting this stuff. It probably, you know what I'm saying? It seems like the death of Disney is in the air, kind of the stench of it is in the air, but that's again, just my take. But yeah, I feel like people are so tired of the woke thing. I think the actress kind of imbued a sense of like, people aren't going to like this film and we know it, but I'm just going to get my paycheck and phone it in.
So Harrison.
No, I agree. Yeah, it's all downhill from the start with big crowd scenes. And as soon as you see them all dancing around, all being happy together, it immediately takes away the European heritage of when this story was actually set. And then, like you both said, when you got Julius Malema taking her into the forest and being the only black man in history not to use a knife on a white woman, that was the most unbelievable part of this film, other than the dwarfs. But they don't care. The original Disney would have cared, but they know what they're doing. And as Donald said as well, Rachel Zegler knows exactly what they wanted out of it. She even said it herself in all the interviews, which is why she got such negative attention, because it's not 1937 anymore. She doesn't want to look for love. The prince probably wasn't even going to get a kiss until people started kicking off. And you can tell that from all the reshoots and how there's absolutely no chemistry between her and him. But it's what we expect. The Black Little Mermaid was bad enough, but the reason that was successful is because the actress that played the Black Little Mermaid didn't slag off the old Little Mermaid or other people. She came across as more likeable than Rachel Zegler somehow.
Well, we'll talk about this briefly before we go on to some of the more woke rewrite sections of the film, where they completely change the film to meet sort of modern narratives. But this has got to be a big thing, hasn't it? Because this was produced, or this was sort of kickstarted during the Biden administration, when it was kind of like, let's all go woke, let's push it down the white man's throat. And Rachel Zegler was obviously picked because she wasn't white, and because she was obnoxious, and because she was hopefully going to appeal to a young, woke, you know, multiracial, multicultural, mixed heritage audience. And she just totally didn't. But it is, I mean, they sort of got everything wrong, didn't they? They got literally everything wrong. Picking somebody who hates the actual franchise and doesn't like the original and wants to basically knock down the film that really built Disney and that was Walt Disney's sort of big breakout film that, you know, built his studio. I mean, that is a mad idea, isn't it? You know, it just doesn't work. And she was so obnoxious in interviews and she was really, really coming off badly. But she was coming off so badly that one of the actual Disney execs, I don't know if you heard this, actually flew out to sort of put a leash on her and say, look, you've got to stop this because, you know, we've spent $270 million, probably more on this, and you are tanking it, not just for yourself, but for everybody who played a part in this. So please stop. But, you know, and again, I'm not someone who looks at a film and thinks it's bad just because there's a black character in it. So, you know, when Disney produced Moana, which is a film about Polynesians, and obviously it stars a Polynesian girl and a Polynesian man, I'm actually happy with that. If you want to make a film about people who aren't of European descent and their culture and their heritage, great. If it's a good film, superb. And I'm happy for it to be centered around Polynesians. What I don't want is people to make a film about a classic European fairy tale set in Europe in, you know, medieval times, and then turn it into a woke multicultural, you know, snore fest with terrible CGI. I think that's quite the thing. But do you guys have anything to add about Rachel Zegler before we go through, and about her conduct before we go through, you know, some of the woke bits in the film? And we'll each try and pick one or two things and explain what we thought of them.
I did see her and Gal Gadot, Greenstein, on the red carpet at some kind of, you know, promo event. And I'm telling you, the thing she said was just totally insufferable. It was the whole kind of, we're rewriting this myth and, you know, we don't need men. And it was very, she had a kind of like venom in her, you know, and the way that she presented this. And I'm like, you just played Snow White. Like, this is supposed to be this iconographic kind of like pure feminine archetype. And now you're being a B-I-T-C-H, you know, like you're acting in a way that is really unbecoming of this. And then just literally what you're saying, like people would have to put a leash on her, like to go out and do that. I think everybody knew that it was going to be woke anyway, even if she didn't say anything of that nature. But to do that, just poured acid on it. You know what I'm saying? And Gal Gadot is kind of smiling and nodding like, yeah, you know, we're taking back the power or whatever, you know, that kind of feminist anger that they all have, you know. And I mean, of course, I wasn't going to watch the movie until, of course, being invited on the show, etc. But when I saw that, it just really was just another punch in the gut. And it's not unusual. It's expected at this point. But it's good to know. To me, I celebrate the death of Disney in Hollywood. I it's glorious. I love it. I love to see how it's imploding and imploding. But there's a side of me that thinks, like, how, you know, these people just print money, basically. Like, how is it that that they can continue to make these movies that they know are going to flop, you know, at these dollar signs? And, you know, because, and again, in the end, I really feel like our enemies, it's not about making money. They have all the money in the world. They control the world banks. They're all in one little club and you're not invited, you know? And so they make these movies to insult us, to demoralize us, to break down our history. That's what it's really for. It's not about money. You know, this is my kind of, again, metacognitive perspective on these things. But Harrison, what do you think?
I mean, her and Gal Gadot, as we'll call her, absolutely hated each other anyway for their own personal politics. And the fact that she was banned from her own premiere, being the star of the film, is even more hilarious. But she's only got herself to blame. She didn't have to take the role. She should have said, I ain't white, so why are you making me this significant character in Disney and story's history? Or she could have just took the job and shut her mouth. But I think you're right. They don't care. They're just spending money to demoralise white people. And as much as they may, they never go bankrupt because the you-know-whos will always give them more money. if it demoralizes us.
It reminds me a little bit of an interview with Harrison Ford playing the part of the Red Hulk in the new Captain America. So new Captain America is black. It's they blah, blah, blah. They refurbish the Falcon character who is originally black in the comics. But again, this idea of like, we're replacing the white man from his own narrative. You know, we're going to put a black man in his place. And then Harrison Ford like hates Marvel and hates the Hulk and all of these characters. And so somebody asked him in an interview, why did you take the role then? You know, if you think it's so silly. And he goes, well, the money. And, you know, he's half Jewish, I believe. And I'm just kind of like, you know, like to me, especially being a comic book artist, you know, I stream Militia Man almost every night with my graphic novel. And, you know, to me, superheroes are American mythology, and it's really just a spit in the face. It's just a spit in the face when you see the way people behave in this way. And I did catch some of that movie online, and it's just what you would think it is. It's super woke, you know. So, like, I strongly urge people, don't waste your time on that.
Well, I want to talk about a few of the super woke things in this film, because there are quite a few. Now, one of the things about this film, which amazed me, because when you watch them back to back, and we watched them over this weekend, we watched Snow White yesterday, and then we watched Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs yesterday, and Snow White today. And I've got to say this. There is a section in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs when she breaks into the house. And I discussed this earlier. So she breaks in and she's like, oh, the beds are so small. Everything's so small. There must be seven children living here, but the house is a pigsty. And this is very good, because it's like, that's how men live. You can imagine if seven men who worked all day at a mine lived together, it would be a pigsty. You can just imagine it being like that. She's like, oh, it must be a pigsty because they're children. And this is funny. It's sort of a whimsical take on how hardworking men are, because, you know, hardworking men, they come in at night and they want a good feed, and they don't want to then dust and clean the house. It's a good take on hardworking men. So she's like, you know what? There's no bed for a mummy or daddy, so I'm going to clean up for these children. And she cleans the house from top to bottom and tidies it all, and all the animals help her. And then when the dwarves get home, she's so exhausted from cleaning and tidying the house that when the dwarves get home, they're like, wow, the house is amazing. And she's like asleep on the bed or across the beds, because the beds are so small. And they wake her up and like, oh my God, it's a beautiful woman. And they basically let her stay in the house because she's done the cleaning for them. And then she's like, look, I'll stay here and I'll carry on doing the cleaning, and I'll also cook you nice, nutritious meals. And they're like, well, look, if we can have a lady in the house, we've all got to clean and wash, and we've got to be smart men now. And it's quite a whimsical take on the male-female relationship. Men work hard, the women stay at home and look after the house. And then, you know, the men clean up and they make themselves look spick and span and the best, you know, these dwarves are looking the best they ever could. And when they walk out to work, she gives them a kiss goodbye and they all love it and blush, and even Grumpy, he enjoys it. And it's so traditional, whimsical, pleasant, and anyone could relate to it. Not in the new one. In the new one, she walks through that front door, she collapses on the bed, and when she gets up, she sort of scolds him. He's like, look, what are you doing, guys? Your place is a tip, and I've turned up here, and I don't want to live in a pigsty. Get cleaning it. And she basically directs the dwarves, not dwarves, to the dwarves, not dwarves, the magical creatures, to do all the cleaning for them, for her. So imagine that. I mean, what is the narrative there? Because the narrative's clear. The men are hardworking men. They're without the feminine touch. They've become a little bit sort of too manly because of the lack of a female in their life. She turns up, cleans up the house, cooks nice food for them, and they all become chivalrous, nice males, and they have a nice relationship because she does the cooking and cleaning. They go out to work, they soften up a little bit, and she sort of mothers them, and it's nice, and they all secretly fancy her. It's a lovely story. But what is actually the message of the new one? What is the message of the new one? She turns up, she sleeps in their bed, she demands a place to stay in their house, and then she says, even though you're letting me stay at your house free of charge, you don't even know me, I want you to clean the damn place up so I feel more comfortable. I mean, this is literally the tale It's not the tale of a charming young fair princess. It's the tale of a spoilt, horrible, entitled brat who doesn't think she should do anything. It's absolutely horrible. You know, it's awful. And she also referred to the love story as a creepy stalker's tale. Well, I think every woman today would love a princess to follow them into the woods and rescue them. Well, not Rachel Zegler, that's creepy. But they were the two major woke rewrites that I saw. Did you notice any, guys?
Yeah, here's the interesting side of that, is that in the beginning of the film, in contrast to what you're saying, she was essentially a prisoner in the palace, and she did the laundry and she mopped up, and woe is me, I'm this, you know, this slave princess that has to do all the cleaning around the palace. And but then when she gets to, you know, the dwarves' house, that happens, and then suddenly she's girl boss, and I'm gonna yell at you until I get what I want. You know, that kind of, you know what I mean, that the kind of mean-spirited, mean girl power, you know, that thing. And I recall in the movie, they almost attack her. They kind of approach her with weapons and like, who are you? What are you doing in here? And I don't know, it again, and it's kind of dark and they look ugly. Just the whole thing's weird. You know, it's just weird that these things are upside down, just like you said. I really feel that they must have had a lot of meetings with the writers and the producers to go through the legend and the original Walt Disney film with a fine tooth comb, you know, and say, okay, let's catch every little piece of traditionalism and mess it up and screw it up, turn it upside down, take it out, do everything, you know, let's be very careful to ruin this thing, you know, because why change it? Why? I mean, the film is a classic. It's famous. Everybody loves it. It could have been a gigantic hit. But they ruined it. You know, I don't see how you can intentionally, you know, drop the ball. I don't know how to say this. Like, how can you screw up so badly? The only reason is because you intended to. That's my thought.
It's such a far cry from the book as well. So the original story, the Seven Dwarfs are like, look, you've turned up here. You can stay as long as you have the food ready and everything's tidy. And then in the 1937 cartoon, they're a bit friendlier. She still does all the cooking and cleaning, as you said, Mark. But yeah, in the third one, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, they're distrustful of her. They should have just told her to piss off as soon as she started telling them what to do. Like, you've come into our house, we'll do what we want, take it or leave it. So, yeah, it's very confusing as to what the message is there. I think the other big change was the whole romance dynamic. So in the modern one, she doesn't want love, she doesn't care about love. The prince just can't just turn up and give her a kiss without asking permission first, like he does in the 2025 one. She isn't waking from her slumber by romance, she's woken up by fighting back against tyranny and helping her multicultural village. It's disgusting.
So I think we're going to round this section out before we give our thoughts, and then we're going to do the super chats. If you haven't donated tonight, but you'd like to, you can super chat via entropy only. I've explained tonight, I explained last stream, the Odyssey super chats don't work anymore because Stripe snaked on Odyssey. If you would like to support the stream, it'd be very much appreciated. You can do through entropy, and we'll be answering those super chats soon. But I want to just talk briefly about the situation with the box office. So the original cost 1.5 million. It went on to make 418 million at the box office. It was a phenomenal success, you know, unbelievable return on investment, you know, by anyone's standard. I mean, at the end of the day, you're not going to get a much better return on investment. I think it's nearly 300 times. They made nearly 300 times back at the box office what they spent. This one, before reshoots, cost 270 million, and it's made 180 million at the box office. Well, you know, Disney are only going to get half of that back, meaning that when the film probably will end up taking about 200 million in total, Disney are going to lose 170 million here. Now, my question for you guys on this is this the end for these woke films? Because usually, and this is an observation, because I've got people in the chat saying, look, these people have got more money, money's not important to them, they'll keep doing this. And I've heard this argument before. And usually when there's pushback against a film like this, like there was against Ghostbusters when it was the all-female Ghostbusters, when there's pushback, the producers, the studio, and the actors involved will all start making excuses for why it failed. They'll all start saying that the audience are racist or sexist, or the audience are bigots. And, you know, the audience is wrong, not the studio. This is the first time I've ever seen something attacked for being woke. And during that attack, the studio have backpedaled. So during this, Disney executives have banned Rachel Zegler from doing any more interviews. They basically try to backpedal on the wokeness. Glenn 19 said they don't care about the pushback. It's obvious because they keep making these films. But this one seems different. It is genuinely the first time that the studio hasn't sort of castigated the audience as just a bunch of racists. Like, I remember, and I keep going back to Ghostbusters, when it was the four female Ghostbusters and that flopped. You know, the media, the press, all of the big reviewers were saying, no, it's a great film. I remember even Bill Murray did this. Bill Murray, you know, one of the original Ghostbusters, went on a show and was like, it's terrible what's happened to them. These women are comedy geniuses. And he was literally bigging them up. But now the opposite is happening. You know, I don't see any press or media outlets defending this film. I don't see the studio calling anyone racists. In fact, quite the opposite. The studio executives were running around trying to gag people from saying sort of, you know, anti-white, woke or liberal, you know, political statements. I think this is a real, well, it appears to be a turning point. Now, the question is to both of you, is this a turning point? You know, are we going to see an end to this kind of thing? Is, you know, and will an end to this be speeded by the Trump regime? Because this was a film that was made for the Biden regime, wasn't it? And it just doesn't seem to be flying in sort of MAGA America.
Right. That's such an insightful angle on this whole thing about when it was made, whom it was made for. Brilliant question. I didn't actually even see that as well. I'm just looking at this thinking this film is a gigantic testament to how powerful and important the arts are to controlling our heritage and narrative. It's also an exhibit of how deeply our enemies hate us for being white. So this movie demonstrates that we're in a kind of generational war. You know, there's going to be kids today that only see this movie, and that's all they'll have. You know, they won't know. You know, they'll be disconnected from their history. They'll have that kind of ugly as beauty and all that garbage that we talked about. It points out that we're actually engaged in a centuries old war. You know, this is why I do what I do in the arts, you know, of our culture, and why I hope my presence on this show can draw more attention towards the creators in our movement. You know, we're maintaining our narrative, we're creating a legacy for our people. And so that's a whole thing that, you know, people need to get plugged into. It's not just political takes. There's a lot of culture happening. So try to, you know, if we are sort of criticizing these things, but not doing anything, then it's lopsided. We, you know, especially people that come to these shows and that are connected to this movement, you know, more connection to the arts and these creators. But the Trump regime and that whole context, that's a pretty huge question. I mean, of course, there's the whole issue of Trump being a Trojan horse and surrounding himself with his former enemies and like the big lie of, you know, of sort of Trump being the savior of America. And it's a massive can of worms to open there. But there is the, you know, there still is a spirit of hope. You know, we're not under Kamala Harris, you know, and like accelerated death under that insanity. So, yeah, I strongly feel that in America anyway, we're done. We're totally checked out. Everybody's checked out. You know, people who are non-political are checked out. And the numbers show, you know, I mean, this film has flopped hard, real hard. So that being the case, I think the numbers don't lie. So I do feel that it's interesting because I think Disney is going to have to reinvent itself, but they don't know how, because their whole meaning and purpose in life is just to take a dump on Western civilization and to deconstruct us. So as long as there's still money to do that, I assume they're probably just going to keep, you know, beating a dead horse. I really don't know. It's tough to say, but I do feel that this film is definitely a kind of a signpost on the road towards the, you know, the death of the woke culture anyway. So that's pretty much what I have to say. I'll pass the mic to Harrison.
In terms of Disney, I think they are going to backpedal massively, because I know they were planning a live action Tangled, which they've now cancelled because of the reception to Snow White, which means Rapunzel was probably going to be played by Lizzo hanging a fucking weave out of the tower. But when you look at, in general, across the woke culture, the films that are doing better are your generic action films without some blind race casting, like the Jason Statham film that came out about the same time, has doubled its box office because it's not pretentious, it's just people want some escapism. So I think they will dial it back for a bit, but then, like as always, once everyone's settled and enjoying films again and all this nonsense has stopped, the old hand rubbers will start going, let's inch it up again, let's inch it up again. And it's just going to carry on until we take over.
Well, let's do some of these super chats. If you haven't super chatted yet, but you'd like you say, please do so. I'll be reading these out now, and then we'll give our final thoughts at the end of the evening. So the first super chat is from John, who gave $150. Thank you for being so very generous. And he says, "Hi, Mark. Thanks for the recent interviews. Well, I'm pleased you're enjoying my work, and thank you for contributing." It's contributions like that that very generous, and obviously, you know, I appreciate them greatly. So thank you so much. Nick Bod gave $10. Thank you so much, and said, "White power." Well, thank you very much. Open Borders for Israel gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, "What's up with Odyssey, Mark? I can't send you super chats. P.S. Gal Gadot is Jewish and ex-IDF. P.P.S. Did you know that Ron Unz is Jewish, even though he was an excellent guest on your show, right?" Yeah, I did know Ron Unz is Jewish. His body of work is fantastic, though. I did know that Gal Gadot is Jewish and ex-IDF. However, she's IDF in the sense that she did her national service. She's not IDF in the sense that she was a professional soldier. She was a conscript who essentially just did national service. And as I've explained, I'm going to explain this again very briefly. Thank you for all your support, guys, over on Odyssey, you know, in the past. But Odyssey is not doing super chats anymore because Stripe demonetized them and has put every single content creator there, you know, in jeopardy. So if you want to support my work, you'll have to use Entropy. The link is in the pinned comment in the comment section, and it's also in the description of the video. And, you know, I flash little things up on screen like I'm doing now, saying if you'd like to donate, please use Entropy. Link in the pinned comment. Thanks. So thank you to everyone who does that. VM gave $3. Thank you so much. So the drive for live action Disney remakes is to replace the classics. Sure, you can buy DVDs, but everyone uses streaming services, which can pick what they remove because it's not current. Yeah, I agree. But I do think, look, I'm not all against remakes. And I think sometimes remakes do have a place. You know, I think if you look back at some films, there were certain things that couldn't be realized, or that certain visions that directors felt they never truly realized because of certain technical limitations. And if people go back and say, "Look, I'd really like to pick that project up, it's a real passion for me, I want to develop it fully, but due to certain limitations I couldn't at the time." But in the case of this, nothing was added, and there was nothing that could be added because it was done in animation format. So yeah, it was obvious that that's what they were trying to do with this. But thank you for the super chat. R. Clodwig Von K gave $20 and gave a lengthy super chat. He said, "Mark, somebody in the chat pointed out that Disney made war propaganda films, which is true. However, with regard to that, I would point out a very interesting argument in historian Andrea Nolan's essay, Walt and El Grupo, at her now deleted blog, she points out that Disney was hit by a strike on May the 29th, 1941, which was led by secret Communist Party member and Soviet spy Herbert Sorrell. She adds that this strike hit Disney completely out of the blue. He couldn't understand. 1 week after the start of the strike on June the 5th, FDR asked Walt to take part in a US propaganda mission to South America. Nolan adds the Disney Studios strike wasn't resolved until the end of Walt Disney's South American tour of duty. Walt Disney Studios would limp through World War II making propaganda cartoons for FDR and his British spy buddies. Nolan writes, speculating that Walt may have been forced to participate in 1941 propaganda drives through commie union thug tactics. I actually heard that myself, but from something else, from another source. And I actually heard that the Jewish mafia were involved in preventing companies who were anti-war from leveraging their position against the government and the establishment and preventing them from essentially trying to stop US involvement in World War II. And that was also true in New York, where Jewish mobsters readily admitted that they collaborated with US government officials to attack anti-war meetings and anti-war activists. So very dark history there of Jewish involvement in ensuring that World War II absolutely involved America and ended the way it did. British Gammon gave $25. Thank you so much, my friend, and thank you for moving over to Odyssey. That means a lot to me. You've always been a very, very good supporter, and I appreciate that from the bottom of my heart. Thank you. And he said, Disney hired a Latina to play Snow White in order to destroy something white and European. It's hilarious to me that said Latina is now destroying Disney. Smiley face. Well, thank you. And I agree. This has really backfired on them. But I've got to say this. There are films for different racial groups. And that's, I don't think that's even racist to say. You know, if I was making a film aimed at, say, the Chinese, it would be very different to a film that I would aim at Europeans, which would be very different to a film that I would aim at, say, African-Americans or blacks. You know, it's the same with humor. Like, black Americans have a specific type of humor called barbershop, and it's quintessentially black. It's quintessentially African-American. Now, I wouldn't want to make barbershop white because it's just not our thing, is it? It's their thing. But equally, I don't want my thing, you know, turning black. And I think this is clearly a case of the kind of fairy tale that would, if this had been done right and a live action remake had been done correctly with excellent CGI, fitting actresses, and everything was done as it was meant to do. And even if they'd done CGI dwarves and they'd been better, but they'd been proper dwarves, and it had been done in a whimsical, fun fashion, and it was a real love letter to the 1937 original, I think it would have been massive amongst white America. And white Americans still make up about 59% of America. And there's lots of white Europeans. We you know, white Brits still makes up 70% of the people living in Britain. You know, there are all of the people out there who would have gone and watched this. And the Chinese market would have watched this because the Chinese market loves traditional European tales. What the China, and this is the funny thing. This crap doesn't just upset white Americans. And that's who it was designed to upset. It was designed to upset white Americans. But this bond in China, and I've said this before on streams, but the Chinese have a particular love for sort of European, sort of, you know, high fantasy, swords and sorcery, fairy tales and culture. And I'll give you an example of this. The film called Warcraft, which is basically sort of it's based on a computer game, but it's a bit like Lord of the Rings. It's orcs versus humans. And that came out in America and it completely bombed. But the Chinese couldn't get enough of it. Now, it cost $160 million to make, but it made $439 million at the box office. So it made a modest profit. It did not flop in the way that this is going to flop. Now, the interesting thing with Warcraft, and I'm just looking at the exact figures on Box Office Mojo, is Warcraft took a very, very disappointing 47 million at the domestic box office, but it took a very impressive 391 million elsewhere, taking it to a worldwide total of 440 million, according to Box Office Mojo. Now, as I said, it ended up making a modest profit for the studio. So, you know, when I say a modest profit, you know, in total, the studio took home 220 million. So the studio made 60 million profit off this, off 120 million, off 160 million budget. Not perfect, but good. It's a profit. And that was largely from the Chinese market that liked sort of a Tolkien-esque, you know, white men in armor fighting, you know, big scary orcs who have invaded their land. And this is interesting, isn't it? That this stuff doesn't just, you know, annoy white Europeans. It annoys the Chinese. It annoys people in Korea. It annoys people in Japan. They just, people all over the world turn off when this sort of multiracial slop's pumped out. I don't know if you, Donald and St. Harrison, have any thoughts on that.
Well, look how annoyed they are with the black assassin in the new Assassin's Creed. I'm not a gamer, but I've seen that people are quite annoyed, including the Japanese, that there's some black samurai they pulled out of their ass to in the game.
Right. I lived in Asia for 5 years and worked for Asian companies for other years and et cetera. So I'm intimately aware of the love that several Asian countries have with Europeans, with white people. And it really, really does break their hearts when they see this kind of stuff. They absolutely reject that. And they did not grow up in our context. They don't have any filter about racism. They'll just call it as they see it, bang, you know, right out and open. And I mean, China specifically, you know, the great history, great culture, great accomplishments. And so there's a kind of on par thing, even though, you know, we're the highest IQ of the races, whites and Asian, Chinese, et cetera. So I don't know. It's just one more finger that points to the truth about this whole thing about white replacement, about woke entertainment, and what a flop it is. You know. But I think,
thank you.
I don't know if we're getting to our closing thoughts or are we taking super chats?
We got one more super chat left. If anyone wants, we got two more super chats.
Okay.
John Tamominari, good to see you back, my friend. Gave $3. Thank you so much. Said, who do they make these films for? They bomb in the Asian box office and even in brown countries such as Turkey and India. Black Little Mermaid completely failed in China and India. Well, I think we just answered that question, mate, before we even read it. But yeah, I don't know who they're making this for because, as I said, the Chinese totally hate this, but the Chinese have propped up sort of European high fantasy films, even when America turned their back on them. So I think they're making them to push a point, but this completely flopped. And finally, Dusty gave $5 and said, thanks for the show. Well, thank you so much, Dusty. And I really appreciate everyone jumping over to Entropy tonight to help support my work. Anyway, if anyone wants a super chat, we will obviously just still answer them. We'll do a quick roundup if anyone does any late ones at the end. But I'm, for the time being, we're just going to do the roundup. So I'm going to give this film out of 10, 1 out of 10. And I'm giving it 1 out of 10 for two reasons. So it gets partial credit. It gets 1 out of 10 because the CGI animals, as the wife pointed out, were very, very good. So I'm going to give it partial credit for that. And I'm going to give it ironic partial credit for putting the Black Huntsman in a beret so he looked like Julius Malema. And I'm also giving it partial credit for the Evil Queen being Gal Greenstein because, you know, there is a certain irony that Disney probably weren't thinking about a beautiful woman hiding who she truly is, infiltrating a European castle, being loved by everyone before assuming a position of power, then using that position of power to exploit and subvert everyone who lives in the castle. I mean, and if the film was based around beautiful CGI animals, black men in berets, and a Jewish woman subverting a European castle, probably 10 out of 10. But as it was Snow White, it gets 1 out of 10. But those little ironies did amuse me. At least I managed to say some positive things about it. You know, right. There were a couple of positives. But the acting, the CGI, the political messaging, the butchering of the original tale, Rachel Zegler not being beautiful enough for the role, Snow White being called Snow White because she was born in a snowstorm, all of that trash just makes the film unwatchable. One thing we usually talk about during these things we never even talked about was the quality of the acting and the quality of... We talked about how terrible the CGI was, but everything did look cheap. It looked like, at times, it looked like a cheap made-for-TV movie, and the acting quality matched it. And we didn't talk about that during this because there's so many other things to talk about. But fundamentally, this gets a 1 out of 10, not just because of all the crap that I've listed earlier, but because it is genuinely an awful film. Anyway, over to you, Donald. Give us your final score out of 10.
Well, you've got a good heart for saying all, for giving it a one. I mean, that's very generous because I'm more in the like -5 zone right now. I'm very extreme in my views on art and the power of art. While I was listening to you, I was thinking that maybe the mirror, mirror on the wall was some kind of Kabbalic magic or something. There, maybe there was some sort of black mirror thing going on. But here's the bottom line. I think that the takeaway from this, the power of boycott, the power of opting out, the power of not spending our money on these things. That's the lesson. I think that you know, if we can collectivize that, if we can weaponize that, if we can get everybody on board to, you know, not only not go to see movies of this kind or buy into any kind of products that are kosher, etc., but to actually speak out against things that pay for our own destruction. You see, this is the one thing. Now, in America, there's not many people know about this, but there is a state law that forbids companies from boycotting Israel. Think about that. That's totally unconstitutional. But of course, America is just a puppet state of Israel right now. So think about that. That shows foresight on their part that we could collectively boycott their you know, this, that, and the other thing, things that they fund, you know, and here bring it right down to this movie. So I don't know. I think that this is an important lesson to take away. Just, you know, as far as the art or what have you, yeah, of course there were some good acting performances or something that you can just say, yeah. But overall, I feel that it's an offense to art. It's an offense to culture. It's an offense to our history, our sensibility. And, you know, I'm happy to see it crash and burn. So there you go.
Harrison, you are summoned for a final thought.
No, I'm going to go with 1 out of 10 as well, because it is just an absolute mess of a film. I mean, CGI will get that 1 out of 10, because I didn't think it was all that bad, except for the dwarves. You mentioned the acting. Although she's an absolutely insufferable bitch in real life, I didn't think her acting was all that bad, and she can sing. So I'll give her that, but she was acting and singing in the wrong part, in the wrong film. Just let your kids watch the original and never let this one darken your telly. Just a quick question to Donald. The African-American artist you mentioned earlier, were you talking about Jean-Michel Basquiat?
Yes, thank you. I it's not a name that I keep on my head frequently.
But imagine.
Yeah.
I thought so.
Good call. Good call.
Right, guys. Well, that brings us to the end of tonight's film review. I hope everyone really enjoyed it. I just want to say a massive thank you to Donald and St. Harrison. Next month, I'm going to be trying to get Mike Enoch on to do a review of Upstream Color. We were sad that we couldn't get Nativist on tonight. He got the dates mixed up. It obviously wasn't going to be next Sunday, Nativist, because that's Easter Sunday. And I'm hopefully going to be lying on my back wanting to be sick because I've eaten too many chocolate eggs. So probably definitely no stream next Sunday. Thanks to everyone who joined in as well. And thanks to everyone who donated so very generously. It's been really heartening to see that people have adapted and they're over on Entropy. And as I've said before, if you're one of the people who likes to watch these streams on replay, then send a small donation. Please consider checking out that link, which is in the pinned comment or the link in the description. That will give you the ability to donate if you want to do when I'm not live. You can also donate via crypto. All my crypto links are in the description below. But that's where I'm going to wrap it up. And I want to say thanks to Donald and St. Harrison. I've had a really enjoyable evening. It's been sort of lighthearted, fun, but educational as well. Mm-hmm. And as I said, massive thanks to everyone who donated. But as always, the biggest thanks goes to this amazing community. Thank you for being here tonight with me. Thanks to everyone who shared it, watched it, however you interacted with us. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. I love you all, and I'll see you next week for Patriotic Weekly Review, which will be usual time, usual place, Wednesday night, 7 p.m. Donald, St. Harrison, do you want to say goodnight, guys?
Yes, thanks so much for having me. Congratulations on your new child. And just want to let people know they can find me at Donald Kent Art on YouTube and also on Substack. So we'll see you there.
Thank you so much, St. Harrison.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's good to be back. Thank you, Donald. And yeah, if you're not sick of films, I have a film review I put out yesterday of a wonderful British film that you should all go to my channel and watch. See you next month.
Thank you so much, guys. Good night and have a great Easter.